My name is Joe Barnt, and I'll introduce a little bit about myself. One of the nice things about Holden is that if you want to be introduced to your neighbor, you have the responsibility of doing it. And so I have the responsibility also of introducing myself. I'm a Lutheran pastor from New York City. I live and am based in the South Bronx. But my work is, while I'm based there, I'm not the pastor of that congregation. I'm just given the gift of being able to live and share in that congregation's life when I'm there. I'm assigned as the Lutheran Church in America has a term, a worker pastor or a tent maker, in which you're responsible for a special kind of ministry and also responsible for your own finances in doing it. And so I'm a freelance contractor, primarily in the field of anti-racism work and urban justice. And also I do a lot of international consciousness kind of work. I think that's enough to start off to say about myself. What I'd like to do in these three series, next 3 days at 9:15 is to talk a little bit about the mission of the church in relationship to justice as part of an advertisement, but also to make some connections. What I'd like to do is in the next couple of weeks, for anybody who's going to be around longer than that, I'd like to also do some very specific talking in the next weeks about two particular things. And one is next week in South Africa. I've spent a lot of time in South Africa, have a lot of interest in the struggle against racism there and our relationship to it, have some films and slides in relationship to that also. And then I'd also like in successive sessions also to talk about racism and the struggle against racism and our struggle to be a multiracial nation and a multiracial church. I'd like to also talk about that in specifics. But I'd like in the first three sessions, to speak a little bit more generally about the church and mission. And in the first session today, in order to get to the 80s, I'd like to talk about the 50s and 60s and 70s. And I'd like to do what I think I've not done very often before, and do a little, it's a little risk on my part, I think, and that is to do that in a kind of a personal way, and do a little personal history sharing, or do it through in terms of talking about a personal pilgrimage, and do that for a couple of reasons, that I can tell you my story, you have to tell me yours, and I'd like to get through early enough in all of these sessions so that it's conversation and struggle together rather than my dumping on you, but also because I think that you have to have your eyes pretty tightly closed to know that as we go from the 70s to the 80s, we're in an awful crisis, and it's hard to describe where we are in positive terms in many ways. And I guess there's two questions, you know, like how did we get here, and how do we get out of here? And so I'd like to just talk from a more personal kind of way about how I got here or the things I was involved in to get here. And if they make you mad or make you glad, I don't know which they will, they're said in order to stimulate the kind of conversation so that we can struggle together with the questions, because I'm not sure I'm right. And I'm sure you're not sure you're right either. And I think we need to struggle with some very controversial questions together. And I hope you're willing to do that since there's nothing else to do outside. I'd like to relate to a couple of things in beginning, and that is relate to the fact that the entry into the kind of questions of justice in our nation and in our world and the church's relationship to it takes us into a lot of negative kinds of things, a lot of depressing kind of stories that we tell each other and that we reflect upon the problems we go through. And I don't think that's all bad. Most of you, I hope, have had a chance to hear about, maybe even to see, the sort of theme book for Holden Village this summer called Light in Our Darkness by Douglas John Hall. It's for sale over in the bookstore. And John Hall's primary thesis is that is that we in America, and particularly Christians in North America, have spent most of our time trying to avoid the darkness and prepared a religion that only works in the light. And that Jesus, as we heard Walt talking to us this morning, takes us into a community that that doesn't just simply face light, but takes us into the place where evil spirits lurk, and that the Christian faith exists because we are a broken people living in darkness, and Jesus is a light to be brought into that darkness, and that one of the things that we have to do, according to John Hall, in facing our failure to fulfill our dreams in America, is to face the darkness with this light, because who needs a light in the daytime? Another way I'd like to introduce that, and I hope you have a chance to glance and reflect and listen to people and share with people about some of those theses of Douglas John Hall. There's another person who is a favorite of many people here at Holden, and that is a poet by the name of James Carroll. I'm sure you'll be hearing many of his of those poems while you're here, if from nobody else, from Walt Bowman and John Schramm. The first poem is James Carroll's talking about beginnings, and he doesn't mean just the beginnings in terms of the Garden of Eden, once again, who needs a light in the daytime, but rather the bad beginnings of being cast out of a garden and needing a light in that darkness. And he puts that into the context of our needing a light in the darkness today. We must make the best of bad beginnings. In that way, we follow the God of the Genesis poem, whose beginning was worse than ours, even worse than ours. Like a big bird, he hovered, ah, bright wings, over chaos, over emptiness, over night, darker even than this night of our souls. For we have destroyed not only forests and the bodies of Asian children and the beauty of our own names. Like a big bird, he hovered, breathing out of emptiness, air, shaping out of chaos, earth, loving out of darkness, fire, stirring out of nothing, water, pulling form, pulling color, pulling fragrance, pulling even laughter from the worldwide pit of that bad beginning. And now here we are, at bad beginnings again. A worldwide pit of chaos reaching to our souls. Cities out of air, we cannot breathe. Concrete deserts out of earth, and we cannot grow. Passions of flesh out of fire, and we cannot love. Thirsty rivers out of water, and we cannot drink, or drink nothing but draughts of fear and memory. There were better beginnings than this when we were virgin with our dreams. But we have destroyed not only forests, but the bodies of Asian children and the beauty of our names. We were virgin with our dreams. Earth was where seeds went joyfully. Fire was light and warmth to gather round. Water washed us of our guilt, quickened us. Air refreshed our hearts on mornings of glory. Remember with me another childhood, when virgins were not victims of commerce gods, when earth was not chained to machines of no love, when air was not poison, when fire was not a rain of death or napalm, when water was our swimming pool where fish live. Remember with me another childhood, another May, when we were too alive to talk of life, too ready for the future to talk of hope. Those were days when meaning was not packaged, and we could laugh at preachers and their grimness. We have destroyed not only forests, but the bodies of Asian children and the beauty of our names. But we must make the best of bad beginnings. This is not the end, but our only place to start from. We spring yet with a yearning to live that will end, that will end our killing if we let it. We still wake with a vision of earth that denies our doubting, forbids the remorse that does not lead to new work, old play with the names of men and women we would with some adventuring be still. Guilt is not allowed in mourning. only penance, briskly felt and turned to service. Can you believe with me still, though faith is gone, in the kingdom we forgot? The kingdom called once for all out of chaos? If we live close to chaos now, yet are we close to the kingdom, close as any heart, however hesitant its pulse. Well, I'm going to save the rest of that poem until the end of the session today, if we have time, and pick up on that. And begin with the theme that we must say over and over to ourselves, as John Carroll says, over and over to ourselves, unless we want to live in dreams and pretense, that the reality we have to face in terms of where we are is the reality of that chant that he goes through with over and over again at the place of our beginning. We have destroyed not only forests, but the bodies of Asian children and the beauty of our own names. Okay, I'd like to take you through a quick sketch of a three-part pilgrimage for me, which brings me to the edge of the 80s, and perhaps it touches on where you've been through and where you are as you go into the edge of the 80s as we go there together. And they coincide with the decades of 50s, 60s, and 70s for me. And it starts off with the kind of Garden of Eden idyllic time of the 50s, which except that it wasn't the idyllic times you remember that we thought it was. That is to say that my parents always used to talk and until we got sick of it, and we'd shout at them, would they ever stop referring to the Depression? They used to talk about there being the product of the Depression. And I never really understood how much a person refers back to the time when formation really began to develop their values, and you either stayed with them or broke away from them, but that was the time which gave you your start. And I find myself now doing that about the 50s, the same way that my parents did about the Depression and how that influenced them. But the 50s had a far different effect on me than the Depression did on my parents, because the 50s, which they make all the nostalgic films about to take you back to times of dreams, which were no idyllic dreams at all, were times of post-war utopia, of suburban houses, developments, and shiny cars, and everybody was going to make it, and we were on the edge of making this experiment really work, we thought. There were no dark clouds. The war had been won, and the economy was going, and the description that Walt made of high school, I knew he came from the 50s, were pep rallies and all everything. We were truly the master of our fate and of the creation. There were no doubts. There were no doubts, and perhaps the only sin was to doubt in those days. The church, at least in my experience, blessed it all as part of it, joined it. There was no sin, there was no suffering except on individual levels, personal and individual sins, and the church had only to help us to get rid of those so we could join in with the success that the 50s was bringing us. Perhaps the greatest sin, as I said, the one that was the unforgivable sin, was to doubt. My education, and perhaps many of yours, came with blinders, that there was no poverty, that there was no problem that couldn't be overcome with technology, and perhaps like the Germans in World War II, though, I had to discover, as the 50s end, my first response, when I discovered that that wasn't true, just as the Germans, when they discovered that 6 million Jews were killed under their own noses, was, we didn't know it was happening. As a matter of fact, the one crack in my education, or my indoctrination, if you will, the one crack that somehow got through came out of my German heritage, came out of my Germanness, and as I finished seminary and was able to go to Germany to study, the one question that came through the crack of that perfect armor was, my people, being the German people out of which I came, how could they do it to 6 million Jews? And how could they say they didn't know? The one crack that somehow came through that armor, and one of my major motivations for going to Germany to study was not just to get some more of the German Lutheran theological education, but an opportunity to ask that question. The one crack that came out of the utopian reality that I was infused with in the 50s was, how could my people do it to 6 million Jews? What the Germans did for me was what Jesus did to many of the people who asked him questions. They didn't answer it, but they asked the question in return. And instead of answering how they could do it to 6 million Jews, they startled me with the question, how could your people do it to 6 million black people and Indians? And there's a coincidence in some people's tabulation, at least, of the amount of victims of the American experiment from the time we began till the beginning of the 60s, of the number of victims of the Indians and Orientals and black people in America who made this experiment work for us and became victimized by it, was somewhere around the number of 6 million. And so I was startled, shocked, you know, incredibly, to be able to have the people I came to accuse of guilt to point back to where I came from and say, how could your people do it to 6 million black people and Orientals and Indians? And you know what my response was? I didn't know it was happening. I didn't know it was happening. And I could understand for the first time how the Germans could also then say, while all of that was happening right under their noses, I didn't know. I didn't know what was happening. Well, that was the end of a first phase for me, of especially understanding in that phase the mission of the church to join in with the creation of a Garden of Eden that was going to work, and the church to bless it all as it was happening, and to especially deal with doubters and to bring faith to that dream. Well, the second phase of that pilgrimage was one of a very painful but grace-filled period of being a liberal and a civil rights activist. Painful because it broke up the dream, but grace-filled because it broke up the dream in both ways. And to have to go through the breaking up of that dream in order to bring us to the 80s, maybe, so that we can talk about creating something that is far more filled with justice and grace, to break up our individualism in order to be able to build the kind of community that Walter was talking about this morning, to break up our systems, our sense of belonging to a system that makes it all right to climb all over each other to be successful, in order to learn to find ways to cooperate and to learn to love each other and build injustice. And so that time of the 60s for me took me, like I suppose many, many other people, and I'm not alone in this, to places, to names of places like Tucson and Berkeley and Chicago and Oakland, and many forays into the South like Selma and Jackson, Mississippi, to civil rights movements and student movements and free speech movements and dirty speech movements and peace movements. You remember all those, some of you? Took me to being pastor of parishes in white and black communities, took me to the street and demonstrations, and where Al Pitcher, who's many of you heard in the last 3 days, and I joined in a lot of things together. It took me to jail. It took me many, many places. It took me for a long time in the black community, where my assumption was, what has to change is they have to be set free. And then it took me for a long time to the white community, where my assumption was, what has to happen is they have to be set free. But both places, when I was in the black community attempting to join in the freeing of black people, or when I was in the white people attempting to join in the freedom of us white people, the assumption in both cases is that this American dream, this system, is still workable. It still can be made to work, but it needs to work for everybody. And we have to join in to making it work for everybody. And so for me, the mission of the church, if you will, moved from blessing all of this to not quite blessing it all yet, but still considering it blessable. We're working on it. Moved from blaming the victims, the black people, the brown people, the red people, the yellow people, the poor people, it's their fault that they're poor, and moving from that and just worrying about their souls and whether they can be saved for heaven, since they couldn't be saved very well for earth, moving from that to a kind of a mission of the church that says we have to join in with sharing and charity and development in order that they can get also what we have gotten. And it moved me from being a believer to having doubts in that which the church and state and nation joined together in saying we are building together. I can give a couple of symbols of what I considered my failure and our failure in many ways in the 60s, and many of us. I worked in four ghettos that were being destroyed under the assumption that if the people join together, church and people together, we can make the American system work here, and I failed all four times. In all four cases, including the place I am now, the end of that ghetto is its final destruction and returning it to rich white people and moving the black people someplace else. And so I, in that New Yorker cartoon, which is hanging over my desk because it's not a cartoon, has the businessman on the balcony of a large apartment building overlooking, I suppose, Harlem onto the east side of New York, and the wife has asked him a question about the problem of the ghettos, and his answer is, "Problem? The ghettos are not a problem, my dear. They are a solution." The way it was supposed to change, when black people claimed their heritage as part of the American system, did not work. The second symbol of failure for me is that I discovered, as I went about from factory to factory and school to school and church to church, doing race relations training to help integration take place and to help black and people and white people join together, I discovered that I was doing, and I'll try and explain this term, I discovered that what I was really doing was helping to desegregate napalm factories. Dick Gregory used to describe Hyde Park, Chicago, from those of you who come from those areas, which is a upper class integrated community in north of the University of Chicago. And he described it as that community where black and white stand together, hand in hand, shoulder to shoulder against the poor. And desegregating a napalm factory for me, and by the way, I did once help to do that. I start with some good confessions. I once helped to desegregate a napalm factory, is picking up on Dick Gregory's phrase, is making it possible for black and white to join together, stand together, hand in hand, shoulder to shoulder, bombing the hell out of Vietnam. And that there's something very incomplete in that, as you can obviously see. And that it's not just simply napalm factories, but any factory or institution or even church that uncritically permits the napalming to go on and helps to prepare people to accept it to go on is a napalm factory. Well, the other is, and I don't mean to depress you by all, but I have to tell you about my failures. The other is that I realized, and we thought we were paranoid during the 60s when we thought our phones were being tapped and that everything was being infiltrated by the FBI and all that kind of stuff. And well, the fact is that the newspaper reports and the exposés that have come out in the 70s demonstrate that it's true, that the movement in America was systemically and systematically destroyed by the FBI and the police. Now, you may disagree with that, but my impressions are, when I read the newspapers, that it's all been, that all of my paranoia has been justified. And then I tabulated one day, in a day when I really felt depressed, and then I'll take you into the 70s, which I think is less depressing. I tabulated with a friend of mine one day and found out that 80% of the persons that I had worked most closely with, priests and non-priests, pastors and non-pastors, laity, church people, non-church people, black and white, 80% of the people I worked most closely with in the 60s were either dead, in jail, in exile outside the United States, or whose lives had in some other way been totally destroyed so that they were non-functioning parts of the society any longer. Well, so the 60s for me was a time of an unveiling of where we really are, but for me was a time of a grace-filled time of learning what community is about, learning a lot about what the church was about that I never learned in seminary or in catechetical class, but a time also in which I realized that when I reached the end that there was still more, there had to be more to come, that the integration of people who had been treated unjustly and who were poor into our society was not taking place like it should have, like the rules said it should when the struggle is supposed to take place. So for the 70s, for better or for worse, depending on your point of view, for me they were better in the sense of Hall's book of Light in the Darkness. It's darker than it was even in the 60s, but the light in that darkness is even brighter. And I think that's what the faith is about. And it happened because in the 70s for me were a time of international connections with the church and society. In the bad sense of international connections, I learned that it wasn't just happening to poor people here but all over the world. And in South Africa and Dominican Republic, and in 65 our Marines were invading the Dominican Republic at the same time that they were invading Chicago. and it was taking place at the same time in Vietnam, and Latin America, where as has been demonstrated now, since between 1960 and 1976, 20 separate coup d'etats in Latin America that were either financed by or assisted by our CIA. So the bad sense about how that oppression was taking place, not just here but elsewhere, but in the good sense of discovering brothers and sisters. Not in the sense of our traditional sense of the church, we're somebody who we can pity and send charity or baskets to, but brothers and sisters in the faith who were struggling like us to discover what it means to be Christians, participating and making, in struggling against injustice and being the body of Christ elsewhere, and whether it was in Latin America or South Africa or in Vietnam, brothers and sisters in the faith who are not objects of pity and targets of charity, but sisters and brothers in the faith with the same struggles we have to try and make the faith real in our lives in the midst of a lot of evil. Martin Luther King, when we were working in Al Pitcher and I and other many, many others were in Chicago, began to make the connections shortly after the Chicago time of between racism in America and the racist war in Vietnam. And it was at that point when he became most unpopular, and many people feel it was at that point when the plans for his death began. The making of the connections between the injustice in the United States and the injustice in the rest of the world. And it was at that point that James Carroll can make the connection with, we make our new beginnings, but in the reality of the fact that we have destroyed our forests and Asian children and the beauty of our own names. And so for me, the pilgrimage in the 70s was a time to take a year off and wander all over Latin America and to become in contact with those brothers and sisters who are struggling there, and to wander around the United States quite a bit, and most recently to wander around Southern Africa a while, and to learn from brothers and sisters in the faith a new understanding of the faith that the 50s tried to keep us from having. And the 60s opened the door for me in order that new understanding of the faith that for me became so rich and is becoming so rich for me in the 70s could come in, being taught by the people we used to think needed only to be taught by us or saved by us, learning what it means to be a Christian and Christian community and the body of Christ more than I had ever learned before from the people of Chile and from the people of Colombia and the people of the Dominican Republic and the people of Vietnam and the people of Southern Africa. I'd like to talk more specifically about that, but I just want to just put a few tags about that for now. Well, how can I say it? I can only say it by just blurting it out and then asking you to struggle with me. For me, it has become, in order to be a Christian, a joyful, struggling, grace-filled part of the community of saints, the body of Christ, means to realize that the society we live in and the system we live under doesn't just simply, as we did in the 50s, blame the poor people for being poor, or in the 60s, say that we need to help the poor people so that they don't be poor anymore, but rather the system that makes us rich requires the continued poverty of the vast majority of the world in order for our system to continue. And that's the question that we're faced with in the end of the 70s as church and as nation. The system that makes us rich requires the continued poverty of the vast majority of the world in order for our system to continue. And that's the question that we're faced with in the end of the 70s as church and as nation. As we run out of water and as we can't solve the problems of the cities, as our own nation begins to go bankrupt in its own inflation, but facing also the fact that the structures on which our richness has been built is the requirement of the poverty of others in order to keep it going. And in the structures that we need to build and the changes that are being made in us, and the Christian faith especially that calls us to it, is to discover how we live, how we remain human in kinds of ways that do not require the sufferings of others, how we can stay a free people who want to be creative human beings, but do it in a way in which we don't continue, because we don't want to continue any longer, doing it in a way which requires other people to suffer in order that we do that. Well, I'm gonna stop there. I have a lot of ways I could say that in many different ways, but I'd like to have you have a chance to have some ways of responding to that, and any way you want to.
Can you make any comments this week about Andrew Young's statement about political prisoners in the United States?
Will I make any? Yeah. Did you say?
Or is that not your?
Oh, I fully agree with him. The statement when he made the statement when the political prisoners were going on trial in Russia, and he said that there are political prisoners in the United States. I think of a totally different nature, not for saying something. Our nation, we have the freedom to say and to protest and call for reform. And to a certain degree, Kent State children do get killed. And many of many people get killed and put in jail, but it's not. But we still try to preserve in America the right to stand up and protest. I could be cynical and say, so long as we don't expect change to come out of the protest. but yes, I no question about political prisoners. Some of my best friends are political prisoners in the United States.
Last
was interested in your comment that you said the movement in the 60s was destroyed by the FBI and the CIA and so on. That's a subject of some interest to me. I think that what happened was Kent State. I think what happened was coming Kent State, the people involved in the movement realized the futility of their methods, not the uselessness of their purpose. And I think what happened was that a lot of the people who were involved, you would probably know them much more clearly than I, but some I think of, those people involved changed their tactics. What happened was people like Jerry Rubin, who wrote Do It, now wrote Growing Up at 37 and is involved in the personal growth movement, and Tom Hayden ran for Congress in California, and Mario Savio from Berkeley, who started the free speech movement, is now, as I understand, an insurance salesman. And a young man that I knew in our little town of Wenatchee down here who told me in 1967 that he was so glad that he had taken over the college president's office and created a new consciousness with his demonstrations and so on. He was so glad that 12 people in our little town, as he said, now know the revolution is coming. This young man in Wenatchee is now a real estate broker on Whidbey Island, and he sees the revolution totally differently now. I think what happened was following Kent State, our law schools doubled and tripled in enrollment, and so did our journalism schools. And I think the movement wasn't killed by the FBI and the CIA. I think they helped the people involved realize that those methods weren't going to work.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? I don't want to just automatically respond to everything anybody says. I'd like to have a chance for you to respond yourself. I'll make no pretense of being shocked if any of you are angry or disagree with what I said. you may say anything you wish.
What do you and Andrew Young mean by political prisoners? Or what do you mean by that?
The Wilmington 10. A group of 10 people, including United Church of Christ pastor by the name of Ben Chavez, who I don't remember the date of the year of it anymore. Does anybody remember the year of at a rally that after which a rally was held, there was some burning in the town, and these 10 people were convicted of inciting to riot. There has been it's the kind of contrast that we have to, I think, face, that Walt spoke about, of 1,000 doing $10,000 worth of damage and 15,000 doing $60,000 worth of damage. The overreaction, they have been in jail, and for some time they have had the nation's finest people and some of the nation's most powerful people testifying as to the inappropriateness of that trial and conviction without any overturning of that conviction, because they symbolize the people who are really threatening and not just free speech, but threatening in a way that can't be tolerated. A number of, I don't know the numbers, Andrew Young talks about numbers, of people who are in jail for crimes that are far, either totally innocent of, or that they are far exaggerate the nature of their crimes and protest. They're in jail for protesting.
Would you say that some of them did or did not get what they deserved, though? The only injustice, the way I interpret here, is the fact that some of those that were in fact guilty of committing some sort of crime with the $15,000, $60,000 got away with it. The others were both guilty.
That's one interpretation that's possible. I would not interpret it that way, no. But that's
consider the crime that has been reported with regard to high officers in industry, with regard to illegal activity, and activity that's really very destructive of the whole system in America. You have to say that, for the most part, they don't go to jail. But people without power and without position, I think it's just understood. They go to jail and they tend to stay in jail. If you were to convict the people who do fraud on their income taxes, for example, and probably some of us do, it's what you call white collar crime, that simply does not get what it deserves. Yeah, I've started making clippings now of all the people who've got illegal contracts. And some of them are getting sentences, but you know for everyone that does. It's just a whole range of activity that goes on and kind of expected to go on in high places. In politics, congressmen, business, unions.
I suppose it's possible to speak of a desire of one way of approaching change in America, talk about developing a better system of conviction so everybody could get what they deserved. And we could then quadruple our prison population and then finally, for example, get a racial ratio that's equal to the population. And so that there would be maybe 10 white people to every black person in jail. There's another way of talking about political prisoners if a system of justice exists that just convicts a particular race or class of people, even for the crimes they did commit. Then they're still, in a sense, political prisoners because some political basis exists to make the judgment of which crimes will be enforced and which crimes will be convicted and which and when convicted, which sentences will be carried out. I doubt very much if there's any doubts in this room, given the nature of the evidence, about the fact that's been well documented and written about that our system of justice discriminates against those who are black and those who don't have money, and convicts on the basis then making almost anybody who is in jail, you could say, if you want to really go exaggerate far beyond anything Andrew Young even intended to say, that almost everybody in our jails thus is a political prisoner by a system that determines ahead of time which crimes will be enforced, and that they are, and that is based on class and race. I would not want to, however, speak of redressing that by saying, let's develop a system that gets everybody for their crime, but behind that into a question of the nature of those crimes and the nature of a system that permits those crimes to be, it's not just the system of arrest and conviction and enforcement, but a lot of things behind that.
But isn't one of the problems that people don't foresee any consequences of their actions? They say, I'm free to go do what I want, and this is going to cause some consequence. I hope some good ones, it's going to cause some other ones that I'm going to sort of forget about. And maybe if we did enforce this uniformly, that people would begin to realize that, yes, there are some consequences of the action that I'm going to take, okay, and would be more sober.
Right. I don't want...
I'd like to respond to that.
Okay.
Research has shown that punishment does not deter crime at all. And there's a different recidivism in our prison. It's just horrendous. I mean, that does not prevent crimes. Most people who commit crimes don't enter terms of that. They, you know, like we do when we batter our health, I'll get away with it. You know, I'm not going to get cancer. Why should I stop smoking? That's sort of mentality.
Well, I don't know. I've seen some of the figures, you know, with this law and justice studies that have gone on, that what a low rate of people who commit crimes ever get to jail, especially on the first offense.
Yeah, but you look at who's in jail and how many times the people that are in jail now are black, poor, and you look at the jail rate and say that all people that commit crimes are black and poor. That's ridiculous. The white people, the white rich are running the justice system, they make the rules. The put the blacks and the poor people in jail, and then they can look at the jails and say, hey, the blacks and the poor are the people who commit the crimes. I don't think we stop blaming the victims.
Yeah, we still...
Is that why Patty Hearst is in jail?
What about Nixon and Agnew and countless number of people that are up, you know, way up in the air, political, economic people who've not been committed or have not been convicted of what they've done wrong. Not to say that Patty Hearst hasn't done anything wrong or anything else, but, you know, many people go, you don't see any black person who hasn't got any money getting away with something like Agnew. Very simple, you know, he goes through and makes a bunch of mistakes in his tax income, you know. You don't see the black poor person get away with it, but he did.
Patty Hearst is in jail just because she got involved in the black people. I think I'm under the balcony. Poor people don't make the rules. That's basically what he was saying, and that what happens is that. That if something becomes popularized enough as a technique to cut your taxes, even though it's illegal, eventually it will be made legal. You know, those loopholes that end up in the tax law just don't materialize by, you know, somebody thinking, boy, that's a great idea. It's probably been tried a few times, you know, and they decide, boy, that's a way to cut the taxes down on this particular item. And I think that's why rich people don't go to jail for white-collar crime, is that eventually it becomes legal to commit those kind of crimes.
Well,
it seems to me that we would miss the point that you were trying to make if we tried to argue who is more guilty or who gets caught. I don't think your point was that poor people are pure and innocent. At least that isn't what I heard you saying. What I heard you saying at the end is that we are involved in systems that breed injustice. All of us are involved in them. I can only come back to a couple of stories. I've told this one here at Holden before, but I guess the population changes enough so it can tell be told again. I met with, I teach a Sunday morning class at St. Albans Episcopal Church in Columbus, and all of the people in that parish belong to the establishment of Columbus. They own the television stations. They are the members of the big law firms. They are the most successful doctors and professors at medical school. And they are top business leaders, presidents of large corporations, Ross Laboratories, and so on. And they asked me to do a Sunday morning series on ethics. So I met separately with the lawyers, the doctors, and the businessmen in the congregation in preparation for this. And what I heard from them, I didn't say this, but what I heard from them was disillusionment with the very systems of which they were a part. The lawyers said, the law doesn't work the way we were taught that it works in law school. An assistant prosecuting attorney in Franklin County, which includes Columbus, resigned because he said he just couldn't hack it anymore. The defense lawyers assigned to the cases for which he was the prosecutor were simply inept, so that you did not get two equal adversaries finally discovering the truth. You got, he said, me sitting in my office at 11 o'clock at night deciding whether the person was guilty or innocent. If guilty, I was going to go all out and I had a 99.99% chance of getting a conviction. If he was innocent, I just wouldn't go all out. But I made the decision, not juries. The lawyers were inept. Those are the kinds of stories I got. The doctors said, we aren't really treating the sick. We aren't providing health care. We're competing for dollars. And we have to give placebos to people who aren't sick, because if we don't, they'll go to some other doctor. And the businessmen said, we can't stand any longer to invest our lives in the making of products and the marketing of products that we don't really think are needed or worthwhile. And that's what they were saying. Now, here are three examples, it seems to me, of systems that are inadequate at the core.
Yeah, thank you for not only you know, returning us to say the question is not how can we all find out who's guilty, but begin to deal with the fact that we're all imprisoned in that kind of a problem, but also thanks for taking one of the risks of doing it, of this kind of sharing in an introductory way, in such a personal way. It raises the possibility that it's my experience against yours, and that's important to deal with, but that there is a far, there is also another way that it needs to be looked at, and that is that there is no doubt, and there it doesn't depend upon whether you have experienced it or I, that we are systemically in trouble. In all of those systems and many, many other ways, there are no analysts from the right, left, conservative, liberal, who don't agree that in terms of the way we are functioning politically, economically, and in terms of the way we are distributing food, clothing, health, and shelter in our nation and world, we are desperately in trouble. And we are being forced to discover ways in which it can be done differently, because now it is not only the question and the problem that poor people ain't getting it right, but rather that if we continue the way we're going, we won't be getting it either. We are in trouble, and we have to face those kinds of things that the people who are running those systems are not are also saying exactly the same thing as those who are outside those systems.
Well, I want to pick up on Walt's question, make a systematic statement. You said that our system depends upon the existence of poor. I think our systems depend upon the destruction of the rich, that it depends upon a meaningless kind of existence, which Walt's statement about the lawyers and,
mm-hmm.
in other words, to be caught in the system. Like I was talking to a guy working for General Electric in Burlington, Vermont, and he said, I have to make munitions. I don't want to. I'm caught. I have to earn a living. I have to support my family and so forth. I'm a technician. This is what I'm trying to do. I don't want to do it. And I think many of us are caught in places. I was caught in a system which systematically got students there in order to have bodies to get a budget on the theory that it would get rid of, after 1 year, it'd get rid of 70% of them. But it happened for a year. It had the bodies for a year. And
okay.
I think we're all caught. It's not just the poor. I think we are in a system and sensitive.
We're almost at closing time. I'd like to hear one more, and then I'd like to make a closing statement, and then we'll close for coffee.
We've had a lot of discussion here about systems and kind of caught in a system, and that we need to find a new system, and that a different system will take care of the problems. But I think it's not that we need a better or a different system. But the problem is that any system would work if we didn't have human beings to run them.
I'd like to invite you in the next 2 days, if you wish, to return and continue this. I'd like to tomorrow talk more on the from a global point of view, the realities that are facing us, and I'd like on Saturday to try and present and for our discussion also some points about the mission of the church in a very positive kind of way within the context of this. I'd like to close with two illustrations. One is that the congregation which I'm blessed to be a member of is very, very poor, and in a community that they know is on its last stages of destruction, and they will be moved elsewhere, but who in that congregation of survival and joy have a lot of fun also. And the collect for the 11th Sunday after Pentecost, the pastor was reading it, and in the middle of the collect, he started giggling, and the whole congregation burst out in laughter, and then changed the whole nature of the Mass that day in order that they could talk about what that was all about. And this was the collect that they read, that all of us read on the 11th Sunday after Pentecost. And this, and it continues now because I'm reading it from the new hymnal, so it's not something that's changing. if you can sort of picture yourself as one of the poorest people out of the poorest black community in the United States, listening, worshiping, and then this collect is prayed for us all. Almighty God, judge of us all, you have placed in our hands the wealth we call our own. Give us such wisdom by your Spirit that our possessions may not be a curse in our lives, but an instrument for blessing through your Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord. It wasn't true for them. In the middle of that prayer, people started giggling and laughing at the assumption on which our worship collectively takes place, that the people who are praying together in the Lutheran churches on a Sunday morning are the wealthy ones. And these people also...
I disagree.
Well, okay, I thought that was going to be a closing illustration. Amen.
I am.
I think that that's. I would rather have the people in my congregation respond to that, because I think that we do think of material wealth until somebody protests it. And then they say, oh, well, there is another kind of wealth. And black people and poor people around the world have been saying, we have two gospels. One that is, God has blessed us with riches if we are rich, and if we're not rich, that God will bless us with heaven. You know, and so there's two gospels of blessing. And we do talk about the richness of the United States as a blessed gift of God. Our wealth as a gift of God, which we hope God will help us to use wisely. So, struggle with that. I hope this one won't be controversial. and I'm willing to struggle with you, not only tomorrow morning, but anybody wants to talk anytime while I'm here. I really hope that I'm open and you're open enough to be struggling with these issues together. I do not know that I'm right all the time.